Welcome to Shift with CJ. I'm your host CJ, and together we will explore the areas of health, human performance, biohacking, psychology, and much more that will inspire you to become the best version of yourself.
Most people take things for granted and not as granted.
It's the people that take the risks are the one that earn the big money.
I am tired of people not starting and living their life on one very simple thing, which is they're worried about what other people think.
An interested party. A suspect is an uninterested party that could be interested. If you work really hard, you should benefit more than the person that doesn't. I want to be rich. Let's take that as a really simple question. Yeah. What does rich mean? I believe that you need to be free from that so that you can control what you earn. The feeling I get from the gratitude of others is the most wonderful feeling in the world. I was hungry a lot of the time, and I had to deal with the demons in my head.
Think of something that you can do right here in the moment. You can plan for something, it's great. But if you can just do one simple thing, which is better than doing nothing. Welcome everybody to another exciting episode of the Shift with CJ podcast. Today we have Spencer Lodge on the episode. Spencer, thank you for joining us. How are you feeling today?
Very well indeed, thank you. And thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I've been really excited to talk to you, and we've had some moments before the recording and we've been discussing a lot of things. So I'm super excited about this podcast. Now, one of the things that we spoke about earlier was one of your old interviews that I saw on Gulf News. According to the website, it was shot in 2020, but I believe it was shot even earlier. They just reposted it in 2020. And in that, you shared how you made your first million. And a lot of people who are listening, they're aspiring to be millionaires, or some people are aspiring to be billionaires, but that concept is very vague. They don't know how to get there. They don't know what steps they should take to get there. And in your video, you outlined a simple strategy where you had a bigger goal and then you reverse engineered it to cut it down into smaller pieces. You talked about sales to prospects to suspects. Can you tell us a little bit about that entire thing if someone hasn't seen the video?
I think that everyone wants to overcomplicate everything. And I don't know why. It should be quite simple math, shouldn't it? You know, if you want to earn a million in a year, then break that down, first of all, into months. And so how many months is that? That's 12. A million divided by 12 months, I think, is 83,333. So that's roughly then 20,000 a week. So if we know it's 20,000 a week and we've got 5 days in the week, then that's 4,000 in a day. So then you say to yourself, right, okay, so how do I earn 4,000 in a day? That's where I would start from. And then you break that down. You know, if I've got to earn 4,000 in a day, I've got to sell something, a service, a product, a something that can give me a revenue of 4,000. So if I sell something that costs 1,000, then I need to sell four of them. If I sell something that costs 2,000, I need to sell two of them. So whatever it is. And so that then would mean to me, go find something that you could sell one of per day at 4,000, rather than two, three, or four things you'd sell at 1,000. So if I can sell one thing for 4,000, now I need to know how many prospects I need to make one sale. So if I've got one sale is 4,000, times five is 20, times, you know, 12 is a million. So now I know that. I go, right, one sale is 4,000. How many prospects for four? So let's say I need three prospects for one sale. Okay, so then we take it another step. How many suspects? And I call them suspects. You can call them anything you want. But a suspect is a prospect is an interested party. Yeah. A suspect is an uninterested party that could be interested. So let's say I need three suspects for one prospect. So I've got three suspects for one prospect. Yeah, I need three prospects for a sale. So now I need nine suspects for three prospects for one sale. So now I've got to find nine suspects. Okay, so my job really is to find nine suspects a day. So then what's the strategy I'm going to deploy to find nine suspects a day? And the funny thing about it is that I developed this system back in the 90s before we had social media, before we had these devices and tools that we could all work to our advantage. I wasn't even using emails back then. So if I can develop a system to find myself nine suspects a day all those years ago, yet there are all these tools now to make it easier than I'm sure that everybody else can. Mm-hmm. Now, my process was to go and get 9 referrals. So that was to get 9 referrals every day from by hook or by crook, mm-hmm. 9 referrals. Now you could say, did I get 9 every day? No, but someday I'd get more, someday I'd get less. But if mm-hmm. I needed 9 suspects, that was times 5 is 45 a week. So as long as I got 45 a week, okay, then I would be able to get my million earned in a year. Now, for some people, they might go, oh, that sounds really complicated. But is it really? If you just listen to this part of the podcast back mm-hmm. again and make notes of what I've just said and do the calculations yourself, you'll work out. Now, then people will say, how on earth could I ever find something for 4,000? The mm-hmm. thing that I sell is 40 or 400. Okay, well, then maybe you're in the wrong job. There's nothing wrong with that. There's no crime in that. Maybe you're marketing or selling the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Now, some people say, well, I'm an administrator and an operator. How do I earn that? You change. Mm-hmm. It's the people that take the risks are the one that earn the big money. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go and you have a salary and a job, the company pays you X amount per month. You're now imprisoned. You literally are put inside a prison and you have to run your life based upon the salary that company pay you. Mm-hmm. You have to book your holidays. You have to buy your clothes. You have to pay your rent. You have to pay your car installments. You buy fuel insurance, yada, yada, yada. All those things in the confines of this fixed amount of money every month, which for most people is never enough. I believe that you need to be free from that so that you can control what you earn. If you work really hard, you should benefit more than the person that doesn't. Well, if you and I work for the same company and you work really hard and I don't, and we both have a salary, how does that get recognized? Takes a while, doesn't it?
Yep.
But if we're both selling something and you work really hard and I don't, then the chances are you're probably going to sell more than me. And if you sell more than me, you'll make more money than me and you're in control of the outcome. And so this is the way I look at things.
Mm. So this was you were really early in the data and the numbers. And you looked at all of this thing in a very strategic approach. Like you just mentioned, there are numbers and you reverse engineer these numbers and it sounds simple, but most of the people get it wrong. You were really early in looking at data. What inspired you to look at these numbers? Were you good at math? Were you, you know, you had someone who coached you or mentored you or trained you? How did you get to this type of data analysis theories?
And again, this was a long time ago. This is an Excel spreadsheet. It was just like, I knew that I had to measure something. If I didn't have something to measure, then how did I know how well I was doing? You know, it's like better, more. I mean, what kind of words are they? You know, I want to be rich. Let's take that as a really simple question. Yeah. What does rich mean? You know, let's remove all of the other things it could be and just boil it down to money. What is rich? For Warren Buffett, rich is way more than rich will be for me. For me, it might be way more than it could be for somebody else. What's rich? I think the object that all of us have to focus on is creating financial security. So how do I become financially secure? And that means, let's say you're earning a salary of $100,000 a year. To be financially secure, you need to have investments that pay you $100,000 a year. Then you don't have to go to work. That's when you're now financially secure. In essence, you're financially free to do what you want, when you want, however you want. So people need to get to that place. Once you get to that place, then you need to think about the contribution you're going to make to the world and life and society, what difference you're going to make. Because I'm sure when we die, we would like to know there's a few people at our funeral, and we'd like to know that those people were there, felt we made a difference.
Okay.
Otherwise, what were we here for? I want to be remembered for something. I want somebody to say, he had this impact on my life and my life became better because of it. That for me is whether you call it legacy or, you know, or you're in the ground and you don't care. For me, it has to mean something. Otherwise, what's the point in being here?
It's interesting. The way I think about it is like the same when you're on your deathbed or the people who attend your funeral. I always imagine what would the 5 or 10 most closest people to me or the people that know me were thinking about me at that time. So what kind of values or virtues were they thinking about? Was CJ a kind person? Was he generous? Was he happy? Was he, you know, whatever. And what I looked at, when I look at that, as my ideal thing. Then I started reverse engineering and telling myself I could be those people, those personalities, have those values, have those virtues right now in the moment. And if I do that right now, maybe later in life, people will remember me as that. So it's really interesting when you spoke about that. That's the first thing that came to my mind. So you made your first million when you were 26, correct?
Okay.
Do you know what's the probability of you making a million when you are 26 in the world?
So that was 1996. What was the probability? I'd argue that probably that's the equivalent of maybe 2 or 3 million today. But nonetheless, what's the probability? No idea.
Okay. So if you look at the data that we have from 2022, it's a 4% chance of a person making a million, declared million, of course, under the age of 28. And you had that. When we look at average numbers, the average age of a millionaire is 57 years old, which also, you know, you spoke about Warren Buffett, and then this brings up to this whole concept of compounding, that over a period of time, your wealth also compounds and multiplies, your investments compound and multiply. But if you had to do that today with, you know, the new technology you mentioned, social media, would you do it differently? Or let me ask you it this way. Is there something now that young people, or like people who are aspiring to get to that million, can do differently than, you know, what you did?
Well, first of all, if you were to ask my parents about how easy it must have been for me versus them when in the 50s and the 60s they were growing up, they didn't have even the devices that I had. You know, I had more available to me, as younger people have more than I had. I think that when I look at different people at different parts of their lives, if I had the tools that were available today, holy moly. I mean, that is unbelievable. So it's just like you can reach everybody. If you wanted to go out there and really like conquer, you can do a lot of conquering in your armchair. Well, when I was young, you couldn't. I would have to meet people face to face, which meant I was limited the amount of time I was spending with people because I'd have to drive from one meeting to the next. And sometimes you'd get to a meeting and nobody would be there.
Let's look at today. Younger people, entrepreneurs, now they have so much of tech. There's AI, there's machine learning, so many things. How would you do it differently today if you had all of these tools available at the fingertip?
I'd learn how they worked and then I'd use them.
Okay.
Because they're just making things easier for everybody. I mean, the simple thing, you know, if you want to build a business, what is a business? It's a group of people that starts generally with one person or two people. It's a group of people that provide a product or a service to solve a problem in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Whatever that problem might be. It might be a B2B solution, B2C, regardless. So that's what a business does. So how do you get that business to be as successful as possible? Well, look at what the successful companies do. Mm-hmm. The successful companies are laser focused. They have systems and processes. Mm-hmm. And those systems and processes are deployed continually all day, every day. And the strength of the business is built around the systems and processes more than it is anything else. And so if it is AI is relevant to their business, or if social media is relevant to their business, then they get the advantage. I'll give you a good example. Look at the most successful real estate brokers in Dubai. Mm-hmm. We know them because they're on social media. Now, I'm sure there's a few in the background going, oh, I don't like social media because of some moronic behavior that they've got towards it, or feelings they've got, sorry, towards it. But I know really successful real estate brokers, and I know the vast majority are not. Why not? Because they're what's called just enoughers. Mm-hmm. We call them just enoughers. Is that a Justin? Is that a Justin? What's a Justin? A just enougher. They do just enough to get by. The successful ones do everything and anything. The successful ones that when they see a new piece of technology, or they see a new process that they can adopt and deploy, they learn it, they try it. Look at, you know, Honey from Sotheby's is a good example, one of the most successful real estate brokers. We can see her on social media. We can see what she does. AJ from Provident and Prime Stay. He shares, he has a podcast, he shares knowledge. Okay, Tahir, I forget what his surname is. Another guy producing, Alessia Sheglova from Dacha Real Estate, producing content. Lewis Alsop from Alsop and Alsop, producing content. Look at these people that are using content to create credibility, to create knowledge, to create experiences, to create entertainment, and to create this educational environment for people that might want to buy property or might want to sell property. Who are they going to go to? You know, I know people that still to this day say to me, can you recommend a good real estate broker? I mean, you've lived here all your life. I've lived here 20 years. We all know real estate brokers. We all get called by them every day. Yeah, I know people that are like, yeah, who can I trust? So I would urge everybody to use the tools that are at their disposal and stop with the bullshit. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm uncomfortable. Oh, I don't like making videos. Oh, I don't like doing this. I don't like doing that. To me, it's absolutely bonkers. It's like saying, I'm not going to use the tools that will help my business the most. I don't want to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think tools are one of those most important things that if when we look back at evolution, the reasons Homo sapiens survived was only because of one thing, was because of the tools that they created. We're not the strongest species. We're not probably the smartest, but we know how to utilize tools. And because we made tools, we kind of like grew. So I love the fact that you use the word tools, because tools are like, you know, they're tools for transformation, they're tools for growth, they're tools for everything. And if we are in a generation, at least what I consider, the most luckiest generation to be alive, because we have all the greatest comforts in the world, all the technology, all, like, let's say about your parents, you were mentioning that they did not have some of these technologies, right? Like our parents, grandparents, they didn't have any of this. And most people, even in countries which aren't like first world countries, they have all these tools available. So if there was any time to live, this is probably the best time to live. Our survival processes have been, unfortunately, there are countries where their survival processes haven't been taken care of, but for most of us, it's been taken care of. So I think at this time, if people invest their time, their attention, their energy in using what is already available, and you're doing a great job, and like all these other people, we're doing a great job educating people, entertaining people, and getting that motivation going is amazing. So you mentioned something really interesting, which is about giving back. You know, you mentioned how can you do something and, you know, make a difference into people's lives. And you yourself, you know, you've donated almost $1 million to charity over the past 10 years. You've been doing all of these races to gather money for charity. What's your perspective on charity? Why do you do it? I know that you support a lot of people in Africa. What's the underlying principle? And did you do it once you only made enough money, or you had this thing from before?
Have you ever seen somebody suffer?
Yes.
It's awful, and it's really painful when you see somebody suffer. And it doesn't matter who it is, but when you see somebody suffer, particularly children, you want to try and take their pain away. Mm-hmm. And so for me, when I experienced other people suffering and I could do something about it, I wanted to. And I'm not like a charity guy. I just see the world as quite messed up in some ways. And I see in 2024, people on a flight 3 hours away from here in Dubai living the most awful lives because of being indoctrinated into a system that doesn't work for them, and living under a government that is corrupt and doesn't care to invest the money that it makes into helping the country develop and become prosperous. I go to Nepal and I get off the plane and I just look at it and I go, badly run business. It's the first thing I think. It's not a poor country, it's a badly run business. Now you can go and see three airlines. You can get on one, get on a Qatar Airways and it's mega and stunning. You can get on an Emirates and it's lovely. Or you can get on Ethiopian Airlines. It is not quite as nice. Why? Oh, yeah, but will be the excuses that come out. But when I look at it, it's like most countries that aren't doing well are badly run businesses. Now, of course, it's complicated, and I, you know, I can simplify it all I want. But the more we now know about the free press, the more we are aware that governments are incredibly corrupt, and their drive is to stay in control more than it is to do the right thing for people. You take a country like Nigeria, 100 million people. It has some of the highest quality oil reserves on the planet off the coast in shallow water. So it's easy to access, high quality oil. It's one of the largest producers of oil in the world, top 10 country. Yet the country is ravaged with poverty. The country, if you go there, you have to queue up for an hour to buy your gasoline, your fuel, because there's no oil that's coming out of Nigeria being refined so people can have petrol. I look at that and I'm like, this is a badly run country. I lived in Nigeria. I had a generator in my compound. Next to the generator, we used to pump the diesel from the back of these drums. And the sand, it was actually about the size of this room. Mm-hmm. The sand around it was covered in diesel. And it stunk. And I'm like, what am I going to do with that? I can't have that like that. And I said to the gardener, I said, can we plant something in here? Will it grow? Well, it probably won't grow, will it? It's because it's diesel. I said, yeah, it'll grow. And we just took cuttings off the rest of the trees and the bushes and planted them. And these bushes and trees grew within a few months. So this diesel-infested soil, which to me demonstrated it was really high-quality soil. Mm. So you've got high-quality soil for farming. You've got oil, liquid gold, and 100 million people. And you've got poverty everywhere. Take it to Bangladesh. Take it to Nepal, take it to parts of India. And it's like, come on. And so I see a great sense of injustice there. So what I do is my little bit, just my little bit of trying to help, trying to make a difference. We build a playground in a school in Rwanda so that the kids can play football and play stuff. I mean, I bought 4 footballs while I was in Rwanda for this week. These kids were kicking around plastic bags and fishing nets wrapped together. Mm-hmm. I bought 4 footballs. I think we lost a whole day because we just played football for the whole day with these kids. The headmaster came out. He said, these kids have got to study for their exams. I'm like, we're having fun. And they're like, I know. And to me, it's like these little things that all of us can do in our own way. And it doesn't matter what the charity is. It doesn't matter what the people that are, or the animals that are struggling. We can do something. So I'm not this great charity guy. I'm just a guy that sees something, feels pain because I get emotionally connected. And then I ask myself, what difference can I make? And the answer is always something. It's very easy to say something and do nothing. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's like something and then do something. And then comes the kicker that nobody thinks about before they do it. And the kicker is the benefit to me is always bigger than the benefit to them. And people will say, how? The feeling I get from trying to do something good for somebody, the feeling I get from trying to make a difference from somebody, the feeling I get from the gratitude of others is the most wonderful feeling in the world. And if you are depressed, down, feel bad, go and spend some time with people that are suffering. Mm-hmm. You'll realize you have no problems. And working with children from Bangladesh, which I did for a long time and still do now, what I would argue the single biggest contributor to the cure of depression that I had.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. It's good that you spoke about the feeling that you get, because a lot of the times people think that giving something is only going to bring certain amount of comfort or, you know, some of these physical or mental emotions to the person who's on the receiving end. But Harvard and a lot of other prestigious universities have done studies on people who are generous and who give. And there are 3 neurochemicals that come out of this. One is dopamine that helps you with reward processing. One is serotonin, which we can think about as the happy bliss chemical. And one is oxytocin, which is with a lot of love, bonding, and all of these things. And parts of your brain which are linked with reward processing and more information processing, the prefrontal cortex gets activated. In a lot of cultures and religions, being of service is a part of the way they live. A lot of the cultures that have lived for a long period of time, a lot of the blue zones, always have some element of giving into their mm-hmm. culture. It's embedded because they know, not just from now, but from thousands of years ago, that giving something, like you said, it's not just you're trying to help someone else. When you look at the interconnectedness of everything, then you're actually doing yourself and the earth a favor. In the Hindu way of living, we have a word for this called the seva, which means go ahead and give to someone else. It reminds me of an interesting stat as well, that they have done some studies in aged people, like above 50, 60, who do a lot of volunteering. And over a 5-year period, they've seen that people who just volunteer and try to help someone, their risk of dying goes down 44%. And that's huge, just because they're part of something bigger. And that's amazing. And what you said is everyone can play their part. So if you're listening to this, think of something that you can do right here in the moment. You can plan for something, is great. But if you can just do one simple thing, which is better than doing nothing.
The problems in the world would die tomorrow. All of them would die tomorrow if everybody's commitment was to help and be kind to one other person. Mm-hmm. That's it. So if everybody was kind to one person every day from now on, one person, everybody was kind to one person, you now have everybody being kind to each other.
So how about we run a challenge for everyone who's listening? Do you want to join us on this challenge? Try for the next 30 days. You can do it for your life, but let's try for the next 30 days to be kind to one person in your life. It could be anyone.
Every day, one person. Doesn't have to be the same person.
Okay. So
just the petrol. How often do you stop with the guy that fills the gas up on your car? How often do you stop and say good morning to him? How you doing?
Okay, I get them drinks all the time.
and have a conversation with them. But remember, the gifts aren't what matter. Yeah. It's the recognition, the respect, and the attention. So I always stop and talk to the security guards. I always stop and talk to the people in the petrol stations. I always engage in conversations whenever I can with people because it feels nice to do it. But you watch people's reaction to it because so many people are so wrapped up in their own heads and their own worlds. And I see this here in this part of the world. I grew up where the word please and thank you were really important. Mm-hmm. All right. And I grew up, and if I didn't say please and thank you, I didn't get anything. So if I ask for something, I must say please. Mm-hmm. So I'm like on high alert when people ask for something without saying please. So you'll see it in a shop mm-hmm. or a gas station and whatnot. And it's like, why can't we just be polite to each other and kind? Mm-hmm. Why just because somebody's got a darker skin or from a different country, a poorer country, are they a lesser human being? I don't mm-hmm. get that. Then no one's a lesser human being. We are all exactly the same. We came from nothing inside our mum's womb. Mm-hmm. Okay. We had nothing. We'll go back into the ground with mm-hmm. nothing. Okay. And we are just, we're just people. All right. Some people might have got a better education because of the environment they're in. Doesn't make him a better person. Mm-hmm. Okay. Some people might be taller. Some might be more attractive. Doesn't make him a better person. Okay. And when I watch these people from some countries look down their nose at others, I'm deeply offended by that because I'm like, who the fuck do you think you are mm-hmm. to look down on somebody like that? Mm-hmm. Who are you? What makes you such a special person? What, because your daddy was rich? That makes you a better person, does mm-hmm. it? Because your daddy sent you to a better school. That makes you a better person. Nah, it doesn't make you a better person. It actually makes you a lesser person, mm-hmm. not a better person.
So two things I want to say here. Spencer is exactly the same how he's talking. You know, most of the time, Spencer, there's this thing where in front of the camera, a lot of people act in a certain way, and behind the camera, they act in a certain way. But I would like to say that this morning when I came into the studio, I saw Spencer, we were talking, and you know, there was this lady who was just on the corner, and we were both walking, and you turned back and you said, good morning, and you were waiting for her to react. So I saw this live in action, guys. Like, it just happened half an hour ago. Same happened with the cameraman. He was like, hey, how are you doing? How's your day going? So spot on there. And I wanted to say I had something else as well. the way you mentioned, like, okay, you came from your mother's womb and you're going to go. Most of the times people tell me like, hey, I'm a bit stressed because of something. I'm like, bro, like, you came from nothing and you have quite a lot. So I think you're doing well. You know, start looking at the things that, and we spoke about this earlier. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about gratitude, because you were talking offline and you were saying, you know, how grateful you are with your life. What role does gratitude play in your life? And tell us a little bit about that.
I think it should be not just for me. I think it should be the single most important thing that everybody focuses on. Mm-hmm. First of all, you'll never be the richest man. There's always going to be someone richer, all right? So don't ever think you'll
be perfect as well, right?
Okay, you'll never be perfect. There'll always be someone better. There'll always be a better somebody at something that you do. There'll always be someone
Can I say something? Abraham Maslow, he once mentioned that out of all the men that he's seen, no one's going to be perfect. And a lot of people walk under this illusion that they can be perfect. So they have this obsessive compulsive thing of being perfect. But everyone, if you're listening, take a deep breath. You're not going to be perfect, neither are we, and that's just common. So please go on.
I just believe that if we just took some time, you can take a difficult situation. I don't know, let's take a situation. Mm-hmm. Let's say someone's in a car accident and they're in hospital. Okay, you could focus on all the negatives, mm-hmm. but you could also focus on the fact they're alive. You could also focus on the fact they're recovering. And focus on the fact that there's fantastic doctors and nurses around them. And so what do we focus on? The fact they could have died or the fact that they're alive? Let's be grateful for what we've got. And in that moment, it's really quite clear, isn't it? How often are we consciously grateful? Like, how often as human beings do we stop and say, I'm grateful for that? Okay, you invited me to come on your podcast. Okay, so the time of recording here today is at 10, 11 o'clock in Eid, which is public holidays. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you invited me, and I'm grateful that you invited me.
I'm grateful for you to be here.
Okay, and I'm grateful, you know, it's you know, other people might say, well, it's your time off, you should be resting. I love doing podcasts, so I'm very grateful that you invited me. I'm grateful to some degree that that guy turned that light off up there. It wasn't in my eyes. But it's like, how often do we stop and just be grateful? And I think for me, when I am grateful, I'm never unhappy when I'm grateful. I'm never sad when I'm grateful. I'm never depressed when I'm grateful, because I think it's almost impossible mm-hmm. to be those things when you are. And it's like, are you telling me there's an antidote? Mm-hmm. Are you telling me there's something I can take that could stop me being sad or depressed or miserable? Yeah, it's a little dose of gratitude. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, where do I buy this dose of gratitude from? How do I take it? Is it an injection? You know, is it medication? No. It's just in your head.
Would it be a good business model, though?
You just think, well, if you could bottle it, just imagine that. But it's like, that's what gratitude can do. Mm-hmm. Now, we can keep focusing on the negative. We can always, again, this is the age-old thing that so many people get stuck in. That person, someone you know, does 99 things right. Mm-hmm. And one thing wrong, and all you do is focus on the wrong. Why are you not going, I'm so grateful for those 99 things you did right? Okay, let's get focused on those. One thing wrong, so what? It's like, really? Is that really that big a deal when we add up these 99 things you did right? Because if we really focused on gratitude, all of us, and just said, I'm going to be grateful for all the good things. Okay. Those 99 things, the gratitude around those would make that one thing that was wrong so insignificant that that person wouldn't be held to task over the thing they did wrong. And a relationship is a good example of that, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, you can be the perfect husband and then you do something wrong. Okay. And all they focus on is the one thing. Well, let's just go back to the perfect husband, please. Can we have that bit in there in the conversation? No. I want to focus on that. So, but when you do focus on that one negative, then who does it help? What benefit does it bring? How does it solve anything? How does it create any benefit for good? It doesn't. It creates tension. It creates stress. It creates anger. It creates, you know, war. And it's like, why? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't apply to relationships. That applies to businesses. That applies to business partners. And it applies to governments. Okay. And it applies to countries as well.
most people take things for granted and not as granted. And this is one of the reasons why, mm-hmm. you know, we tend to miss out on gratitude, because we think we're, you mentioned the word entitled earlier. We think we're entitled to all the good things in life, but, you know, for most of us, it's not always going to be the same. Sometimes there are good things, sometimes there are bad things. In bad times, if you can hold on to those good emotions, like you said, it's difficult for you, or it's nearly impossible, and that's proven by science as well. You, when you're grateful about something, when you're joyous about something, at that time, it's nearly impossible for your brain to hold like a negative thought or a lower vibratory frequency. So even when you scan a lot of people's energy bodies, these things happen when you're highly at a state of gratitude. In fact, there are some studies that have shown that your sleep, don't quote me for the exact numbers, but your sleep increases by 33%. Your ability to exercise and perform more increases by 35%. And there's something else that increases by 32%, but I forgot. Okay. You also have a very, you know, great name, being a wealth manager in turning startups to 9-figure businesses. When did that start happening? So like, let's look at our timeline, right? 90s, you're looking at decoding all of these statistics, you make a million. From there, what happens? How do you get to this point where you're actually now making other people grow their businesses to 9 figures?
Gosh, this was many years ago. Of just, once you work out a formula and you know how it works, then all you, what becomes blindingly obvious is like, why can't everybody else see what I can see?
The algorithms, you mean?
No. It's just it's basic math. It's just like, why can't, if this is the formula to make money, why can't everybody else see that? And so what it does is it frustrates you, mm-hmm. because it's like so obvious. And I'm sure if you went to Richard Branson to be a billionaire, he'd say, well, it's not difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, if you went to Warren Buffett, he'd be like, it's not difficult. Because for him, it's for them, it's obvious, isn't it? Bill Gates, it's obvious for them. Like for me, in my point, much smaller, but it was like obvious. And it was like, I could see people struggling. And it was like, how do I help them? You know, and the way to help was to teach them to see. And I've been able to coach people and mentor people to take their businesses from wherever level it was at to much higher numbers, just by getting them to kind of like unlearn some of the bad habits and learn some of the good processes they should follow, and then take action and deploy them. It doesn't always work, but it has worked over the years. And then, you know, I made money. So I invested in businesses, ones that I thought were interesting. And that's how other ways I've been able to make money.
Have you heard about the 10,000 hour rule by Anders Ericsson?
Yep.
Do you think that 10,000 hour rule applies to your life?
I think it's a really valid rule. I think it really is valid. And I think that if you deploy that and literally make yourself the expert, mm-hmm. it's not actually that difficult. If you really break it down, it starts off sounding overwhelming. You talk about 10,000 hours. What does that even sound like? 10,000 hours. It's like, bum, bum, bah. Mm-hmm. And then you break it down and I'm like, and that's just, this is where most people get stuck. Like you mentioned earlier, a million. It's just like, mm-hmm. it's out there. It's just like, bang, big number. What's the process to get there? Oh, it hurts my head too much to think about it. It must be for crooks, bandits, and drug dealers. And so
a lot of people think that way.
Yeah. And so if that's the case, then I can't do that. Mm-hmm.
And why do you think people, when something is difficult, or rather, let's say it's not in their awareness, they cannot see the things that they're doing wrong. They always say that, oh, this is for people who are not making money the legit way, or, you know, like you said, crooks or bandits. What do you think drives people to think like that?
Because that's a reasonable way for them to justify why they're not going to achieve something. Mm-hmm. In their mind, it's very reasonable. I'm going to use that. And they won't be saying, I'm going to use that as my excuse. But what they are doing is delivering to everybody else, that's my excuse. Mm-hmm. And most people don't have willpower and desire and passion and commitment. Most people, as I said, just enough, as they always do, just enough. Most, you've got to think about your conscious and your subconscious brain. It's really simple. Your subconscious brain is a risk management tool. Okay. Mm-hmm. Your subconscious brain wants you to chill out. doesn't want you to take risks, doesn't want you to get on that zip line, okay? Doesn't want to face that bowler with 120 mile an hour ball coming at you in the wickets, okay? That's not what it wants. It wants you not to take any risks. So what it wants you to do is lay on the sofa, bag of Cheetos, and a remote control. That's what your subconscious wants you to do.
Netflix and chill.
Okay, Netflix and chill. It wants you to just slow down, because that means there's less risk being taken. That's why to get up in the morning and go to the gym requires your conscious brain. At the beginning, you got to wake up early. You got to get your gear on. You got to go to the gym. You got to do the exercise. That's kind of like coming away from easy and calm and peaceful. That's your conscious brain taking over. So you're saying to yourself, no, I'm going to get up. No, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to commit to it. But the conscious brain doesn't have lasting power, because the subconscious brain then after a few days says, why do you want to do that? Come back, get on the sofa, mate. Cheetos, remote control. That's where you need to be. And so the conscious brain has to keep fighting that. Mm-hmm. Now, when the conscious brain fights it long enough, okay, because of discipline and willpower, it fights it long enough, it then creates subconscious, again, behavior. That subconscious behavior is a habit. That habit that's then formed is then the norm. So I wake up every day at the same time. It's a habit. I go to the gym every day at the same time. It's a habit. Lots of people say to me, how do you get up so early and go to the gym? And I'm like, how do I not? So most people have created bad habits. Most people are allowing their subconscious to control them. Most people, take something like, I don't know, the trendy at the moment is the carnivore diet. Maybe you've seen videos online about this. Mm-hmm. Eat meat and eggs, basically.
I did it for a year.
Okay, right. So the carnivore diet, okay. Most people give up the carnivore diet within the first 10 days because they can't go through those 10 days because it's tough. Allegedly and apparently, I don't know, but I'm assuming it is. So it's tough to get through the first 10 days, so they don't continue. But the ones that do continue tend to have incredible stories of how it worked for them and how they were able to lose weight, increase energy, yada, yada, yada. But it's kind of, you've got to go through that pain to get that gain. And most people won't go through the pain. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's three things in the world you'd become a billionaire if you was to sell them. Number one, okay, if you and I developed a tablet, people could take one tablet, they could take and they could lose 20 kilos in the next 4 weeks. Okay, for sure, we'd be billionaires. Okay, if you and I, okay, could teach everybody by shaking their hand, they could get rich quick. Okay, mm-hmm. They could become a millionaire overnight. Okay, we'd be billionaires teaching that. Mm-hmm. Okay, or significance, 1 million followers. I want 1 million followers. Everyone wants 1 million followers. Why? Because they want recognition and significance. So if you could teach everybody to get 1 million followers just by shaking my hand, okay, real followers, I don't mean purchased followers, then you'd make a lot of money. And so these are the things that are important to people, because they want a shortcut to losing weight. They want a shortcut to making money. They want a shortcut to significance. And anyone that's ever lost any weight knows there's no shortcut. It's painful. Unless you go for surgery, which is mm-hmm. painful as well. Mm-hmm. Okay. But, you know, I lost some weight a few months ago and it was uncomfortable. I was hungry a lot of the time and I had to deal with the demons in my head. People that wanted to make money, you know, I know the formula to make money. I knew what I needed to do. For me, once I knew that formula, it was then for it to deliver. But if someone had said to me, come and shake my hand and I'll put 1 million in your bank account tomorrow, would I have walked away? Hell no.
Two hands.
And feet.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I like what you said about the habits and the habit formation. There's an author, his name is Hal Elrod. He wrote The Miracle Morning. And in Miracle Morning, he says that there are three phases. A lot of people would argue that, you know, you can build a habit over 21 days or 30 days. But he says, like, it's better to describe it in three phases. The first one is unbearable. So, like, you start something, waking up early morning for the gym. It's tough. 10 days later, you go to uncomfortable. It's not unbearable, but it's just a little bit uncomfortable. You get to like the 30-day point or 21 or whatever it's for you and everyone's unique. Then it becomes unstoppable. Then it becomes a part of you. It becomes a part of your subconscious. And also, the way I like to see it as Nassim Taleb points it, that the best rule in the 21st century is using algorithms. So you could call them habits, you can call them algorithms. But when you do something a set number of times and you know that is good for you, and then like waking up in the morning, for example, at a certain time, or going to the gym, you don't think about it too much. And when you don't think about it too much, you don't use a lot of willpower. But when you don't use a lot of willpower, then you don't make this, you don't get to that decision-making fatigue. So if you could only figure out what brings you the most amount of energy, and I like to divide it into three brackets, energy, what feeds your energy, what feeds your love, and what feeds your work. So everything can, relationships, work, finances, everything can be under those three buckets. And if you can find out the right algorithms and employ it, then it just becomes easier and easier. Because, and nowadays it's even, I mean, like we mentioned about artificial intelligence sometime back, you know, things, there are tools, it's easier, but it's always good when you combine artificial intelligence with ancient intelligence. Ancient intelligence that sits in our brain, 500 million years old in the basal ganglia. It has certain algorithms of its own. You bring some more things, combine them together, and that's kind of what propels you forward. Now, what are some of, let's talk about some of the mistakes. Because you see, you mentioned that you look at someone and you have this, because of either the 10,000 hour rule or, you know, all of your experiences in life or the way you look at the world, you see that some people are making mistakes. What are some of the common mistakes that you see? Entrepreneurs, businesses, startups. Let's keep the government aside.
A lot of mistakes start for me with people believing that they're going to take on the world and become the world's greatest at something in a very short period of time.
Instant gratification?
Not instant. They just think that they're going to achieve a lot, but a lot quicker. They don't realize that when you build a business, it takes time and patience and people to become successful. And there's going to be many hurdles along the way you're gonna face. Mm-hmm. The CEO of NVIDIA, when he was interviewed recently, he was just like, I would never do that again. Yeah. You know, that was, and I get that, because it's really tough. You know, to be successful in business is really tough. And I'm not by any stretch of the imagination in my mind successful. Other people might think, but I definitely don't think I am. It's tough. It's been hard work. You know, I'm 53 years old, and so I'm still at it. And so getting a real understanding of what your expectations should be is something I don't think people do. I also think that people think they can do it on their own and they can't. I think that you need to have a mentor. I also believe people pay a lot of money for coaches, and you should never have a coach. You should have a mentor. And the difference between a coach and a mentor is a coach is somebody that will teach you to do something that's never done it themselves. A mentor is somebody that's walked in your shoes. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm going to learn Spanish, I better speak to someone that speaks Spanish. If I'm going to learn coding, I need to be trained by someone that can code. If I'm going to run a marathon, I need to be trained by somebody that's run a marathon, in my mind. Mm-hmm. I don't want a coach. I want a mentor. I want someone that I can talk to that's walked in the shoes I'm about to walk in. And I think if you find somebody like that in business, it's important. Also, if you're going to start a business and you have other people involved in that business, being really aware of what everyone's strengths and weaknesses are, and understand that a business is just a group of people. Stop complicating it. It's just a group of people. You can use words like rock stars and family and all this kind of stuff, but it's just a group of people working towards a common goal. So let's make sure that if you do it, even though it might be painful, let's have some fun. You know, there's going to be dark days, but let's try and have fun. Let's remember that if we have fun and we respect each other and enjoy each other, that makes the chance of it succeeding much greater.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You are also a super celebrity podcaster. That's something I would love to learn from you about podcasting. And before we started, you gave me a few tips as well with my research. But I want to know from you, you've spoken to the what we consider the greatest of the great people, you know, Tony Robbins, Gary Vee, a lot of these people who have so much to share. What was that one episode or that one person that taught you about something super unique that always sticks with you? Something that you never thought about before?
300 episodes in, it's very, very unfair for you to ask me that question.
Okay.
But in reality, it's also unfair for me to choose one person.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe rather than choose one, I'll give you a couple of experiences. Leon Logothetis really had an impact on me. So he has a TV show called The Kindness Diaries. He traveled around the world on a motorbike, relying on the kindness of others because he believed overall people were kind. He could accept shelter and food and fuel for his motorbike, but he couldn't accept money. When he saw an extreme act of kindness, he repaid it with a life-changing gift. Now, Leon secretly is from one of the wealthiest families in Greece, like billionaire status, but nobody would ever know. And more him didn't want anyone to know. But he wanted to find kind people and wanted to prove to the world that kindness did exist, which he did in two series that were hugely successful on Netflix. And he really profoundly impacted me. And then he was the guy that enabled me to create my documentary for human trafficking that we've just completed. He was really profound. Then I've met people that have gone through unimaginable journeys of pain and horror, and many of them, but the ones that come out the other side without surrendering to life, and the experiences turn them into a better person. So one guy, Alex Lewis, he had septicemia, lost over the course of 2 days. His legs and his arms were amputated. Handsome guy, lost his legs and his arms. I mean, just imagine that. Yeah, how horrific is that? But he said to me, "You can keep them. I wasn't alive." And I was like, "Wow." He said, "I wasn't living. I worked in a bar. I was existing." Now, when he lost his arms and his legs, he then strapped an oar to his shoulders and he kayaked around Greenland to raise money for charity.
Wow.
He then climbed a mountain in Ethiopia to raise money for charity. And he was living. And he was finding mission and purpose in his life. And when you see people like that, you know, Annika Lucas, who was sold into a pedophile ring by her mother from the age of 6 to 11, she has every right to surrender to the world. But she got up and she fought for other people that had suffered. And so when you meet people like that, they're the people that really impact me. I come away from those conversations and I'm like, whoa, wow. And then I've met people that are just very wise people in the world of business, very wise people in the world of well-being, people that understand things in much greater detail than me, that I walk away from going, maybe I should look at that differently. Maybe I could apply some of those techniques or those strategies to my business. People are very gracious. But the people that shout the loudest without speaking are the people that have a mission that's so great.
Mm-hmm.
That it oozes out of their eyes and their pores as they talk. It's just so great that they become it. And when I'm around those types of people, I'm just lifted. You know, I'm taken out of my seat and I'm just so grateful to have that person in front of me.
I feel the same way right now, by the
way. Thank you, man. Yeah, that's what podcasting does for me. And I can't tell you the difference it's made. I mean, Alex is here. He films most of the episodes. Alex, who was your favorite guest? Who did you like? Ooh. We've had some great crypto people on. Raoul Paul, who taught us about crypto. Da Vinci Jeremy did the history of money. Great lessons, like great for everybody to listen to.
That's amazing, Spencer. Now we're coming to the end of the episode. My final question to you is, if you could get back in a time machine, go back to your younger self and give yourself one or two pieces of advice, what would that be?
Okay, so I'm at a phase in my life where I'm kind of like downsizing, not upsizing. It's a kind of phase that when you get to in your 50s, you stop thinking about the things that you thought about when you were younger. So when I was younger, it was like the cars, the watches, the shit, yeah, that you thought gave you significance. So if I went back and I was able to speak to my younger self and speak to my 22-year-old self, I would make a legally binding contract that 50% of everything that I earned was invested.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that would deal with any money dramas that might have existed, because I used to spend money when I was younger.
Any specific investments or
No, just invested, even if it was invested in long term, in the S&P 500, mm-hmm. let's put it there, for example, or crypto. Okay, so that's that. The second thing, okay, I would have banned myself from being able to get married until I was 35.
What age did you get married?
No earlier than 35.
Okay.
Now, people think, why? Because I don't think men are mature enough to be married until they're 35 and above. I think they're just, they don't understand enough about the world. And I think nobody should be allowed to get married until they're 35. That might sound weird. Women might argue about that. But I believe that if you're going to get married when you understand what marriage is, you understand what the world is, and you understand who you are. Mm. I think that's really important as well. So that would be some advice that I would give myself. And also, I would ask myself to try and enjoy the moments more, because a lot of the time I missed out on moments that I could have celebrated and really enjoyed and just lived in those moments, but I was too busy rushing to the next thing to stop and give them time.
That's beautiful. Spencer, this has been an amazing podcast. We have all learned so much from you. Thank you so much for coming to the show. Thank you for sharing your valuable time, your energy, and your presence with us. I'm really grateful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I'm very grateful you invited me. So thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you. And this is it, everyone. This is the end of today's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I wish you have a great day, a great week, a great lifetime. And remember, be present on those smaller moments so you don't miss out on them later. Take care. I'll see you in the next podcast.
Your time and presence with us through this podcast is highly appreciated. If you want to learn more, then head over to our website, www.shiftwithcj.com.